Wisconsin's Afternoon News is on the air, broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. Here are your hosts, John McCure and Julia Fellow.
John and Julia with you. Hope you're, what is today? Today's Wednesday, Julia, all
Arnie
day.
Arnie thought it was Tuesday.
No, it's Wednesday.
I almost said Thursday.
Arnie's wrong about lots of stuff, including apparently what day of the week it is. Arnie's our sales guy, by the way.
We love him.
Glad that you are hanging out with us. All right, let's get to it.
This is the three. At 3 on Wisconsin's Afternoon News.
Number 1, John, is our dangerous heat. This will be the most humid day of the week, according to WTMJ meteorologist Craig Coplane. The actual temperature right now in Waukesha is 94 degrees. Feels like 104. Milwaukee, according to Craig, hit 92 as its high. Actual high today. Right now, it's 86 degrees in Milwaukee. And the heat advisory lasts until 8 o'clock tonight. Then we have something else to worry about. The wildfires from Canada will begin to affect the air quality big time later this week. We talk more with Craig, our meteorologist, on Wisconsin's Afternoon News at 4:20.
All right. The second thing, Julia, today's a big day in the election cycle. It's the day that we have to, the candidates do, release their latest campaign finance numbers. It's until midnight. So they could have already turned them in, but they've not been posted yet. We're expected to know everything by midnight. I just checked the numbers, and there are no new numbers yet. They have not yet been reported. This is interesting. Joel Brennan, candidate for governor, is going to have a press conference at 4 o'clock to release his campaign finance numbers. He's going to tell us how much money he has. Here's the interesting nugget. He's holding the press conference outside the Ethics Commission. That's not where you turn in your money numbers. That's where you turn yourself in if you've had an issue with your numbers. So Sarah Rodriguez said that they've turned stuff over to the Ethics Commission because she told us a couple of days ago that her campaign has mishandled all sorts of money. So Joel Brennan having an announcement outside the Ethics Commission. Is he going to blow her up? I guess we'll see. That is at 4 o'clock. And then on the other side, Tom Tiffany putting out a press release announcing that he has raised money with contributions from all 72 counties. That's not unusual. 10,000 small dollar donors. He says he's raised $8 million during the last reporting period and has $3 million cash on hand as he runs ads on the TV and radio.
Number 3, John, the MLB All-Star Game was last night. What an incredible start. Wonderful announcement of our All-Star Brewers. Here's when William Contreras and Jacob Mizorowski were both announced.
From the Milwaukee Brewers, catcher William Contreras. And the Miz, Jacob Mizorowski.
That was the only time the announcer gave a little nickname. He said the Miz.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I like that. That was cool.
I was listening to it live, too.
Yep.
Yes. William Contreras. And the Miz, Jacob Mizorowski.
It was so fun. I tweeted out the video. And I also wrote in my caption how Jennifer Hudson brought down the house. What an incredible singer. And we'll talk more about that coming up in the 5 o'clock hour.
We'll also talk about who didn't bring down the house. You know who that was? Patti LaBelle singing the national anthem.
My husband was defending her while she was singing. I was like, he
doesn't like the way the national anthem's supposed to sound? So we're going to share both those clips with you, as you mentioned, a little bit later on in the show. It is 3:12 at WTMJ. For those of you driving around wanting to know what's happening in the soccer game right now, there's 3 minutes gone by in the second half. It is 0-0. Argentina and England, the winner, plays Spain in the final coming up this weekend. Potentially major developments when it comes with the war with Iran. Jordana Miller, ABC News, is with us from Jerusalem. Jordana, good afternoon. I want to start with this. We've spent a lot of time talking about the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and what a big deal that is. Reports are that Tehran is now threatening to shut another gateway to the Red Sea, a major global shipping route through which Saudi Arabia exports its oil. Jordana, do they have the means to do this?
They do have the means to do it because they can call upon their proxy, the Houthis, who are out of Yemen, and they can essentially start firing on vessels there, and that would, you know, it would take some time, but it would end up, you know, scaring off shipping companies, and not only carriers but insurers, and we could see that that gateway closed, you know, I would say pretty quickly, actually. So it is a real threat, and it is one that the Iranians are now, you know, using, I think, to try to convince the United States not to expand their military strikes beyond in and around the Strait of Hormuz. That's where we've seen most of the attacks so far. And, you know, just a short while ago, CENTCOM said it has started a second wave today of attacks. There was one that started at 6 a.m. for about 90 minutes, and then at 3 p.m. Eastern, a new round started, focused again on the coastal area of the northern part of the Strait of Hormuz, Bandar Abbas, and Bushehr, and lots of port cities in between. And it looks like Iran's trying to, you know, keep things relatively at a low level of fighting. I know that sounds maybe odd to our listeners, but given the intensity of what we saw during the 40 days of Operation Epic Fury, you know, there's fighting now, but it is not what we saw. It is not at the same level as that earlier, the opening strikes and the opening weeks of the war.
Yikes. How big of a threat is Yemen if they help Iran? Because we were thinking about Iran with the nuclear weapon. How big of a threat is Yemen?
Well, Yemen is a country that's in the middle of a civil war, and essentially the warring factions are on the one side, the Iranian-backed Houthis, and on the other side, the Yemenite government that's backed by Saudi Arabia and the West. I mean, Yemen is an absolute mess. There's, you know, starvation in pockets of it, you know, lawlessness, chaos. It is, you know, because it has less of a geopolitical influence in the world, you know, we're not focused on it as much in the Western media, but, you know, it is one tragedy after another, Yemen. And if they were to get involved, you know, the Houthis are, you know, they are a huge militia. You know, I would say close to the scale of Hezbollah, you know, trained and armed by Iran. They have maybe a little bit more independence from Iran, but nonetheless, it would be a disaster, I think, if Yemen got involved and if the Bab al-Mandeb Strait was closed. I don't think we're there yet, but obviously the Iranians are saying this is a card that we'll play if we have to. What I think is interesting is that the MOU was supposed to focus on the quote-unquote easier issue of opening the Strait of Hormuz, leave the more difficult issue of nuclear, right, of getting a new nuclear deal and limiting Iran's nuclear program, kicking that can down the road because it was going to be filled with a lot of difficult talks. And yet, the Strait of Hormuz has turned out to be an incredibly complicated issue because the Iranians read in the MOU that they were in charge of the Strait of Hormuz. They want to claim sovereignty to the whole, to every lane, and they want to charge tolls for it. And when they saw that the United States was helping hundreds of vessels cross through the strait on the Omani route, that is the southernmost route that hugs the coast of Oman, this, you know, really obviously bothered Tehran to the point where they started to attack the cargo vessels there because they wanted to control every lane. And here we are. Now the war is focused on who's going to control the Strait of Hormuz. Forget about the nuclear issues.
ABC's Jordana Miller. Jordana, thank you. We appreciate it.
Talk soon, guys.
So here's where I am on this. Okay, so let's go back. We launched the war so that Iran, we were told, didn't have nuclear weapons. The president saying Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. we launched the war, we were told, so that we could go in and we could recover the nuclear material that is there in Iran, still in the ground. We started the war. The Strait of Hormuz was open and gas prices were down. Okay, let's fast forward now. We have the Memorandum of Understanding. They still have the nuclear material.
That lasted just 72 hours before everything kept firing.
They still have all their nuclear material. They are still as close as they were to having a nuclear weapon. And the strait is closed. We're paying more. They're thinking about shutting down other waterways. They never thought about closing down the Strait of Hormuz before we launched this war. Now they're like, they're probably glad that we're bombing them, because it allowed them to open their eyes and say, wow, we can really be powerful because we can control the strait. Then they woke up yesterday and went, oh my gosh, we can be even more powerful, thank you, because now we can control the Red Sea and all of Saudi Arabia's oil. And we have accomplished nothing, according to most experts, that were laid out as the primary things we were trying to accomplish at the beginning of the war. How does Israel feel about this? Israel obviously wants the threat of a nuclear weapon gone because they're Iran's top target, and it hasn't been eliminated. Has it been diminished? I guess we won't know because inspectors aren't in there, but the experts say it has not been eliminated.
Wisconsin's Afternoon News on WTMJ.
3:36 on WTMJ. I love the Royals.
Yes.
There's one that's even older by more, up almost 1,000 years than the Royal Empire in the United Kingdom. Japan.
Wow.
And a 24-year-old princess, Ayoko, is the only child of Japan's emperor, Naruhito, and Empress Masako. So they just have one girl. She's beloved by the entire country and the head of state's only child again. So if you want to put into perspective the equivalency to the British monarchy, there could only be a queen in the British monarchy, okay, if the reigning monarch did not have any sons. Hence why King Edward, when he abdicated the throne to the British Empire to marry a commoner, an American twice divorced before, Wallace Simpson, so triple whammy at the time in 1936, it went to the next eldest brother in the UK, King George, who only had two daughters. Hence why we had Queen Elizabeth. It took until 2011 for the British Commonwealth to agree that the eldest child of the monarch becomes the rightful heir to the throne, regardless of their gender. But under Japanese law, only a male can ascend to the throne, period, end of story. Meaning the beloved, beautiful Japanese Princess Ayoko, the only child of the Emperor of Japan, can never take the highest spot. Which is now, like the UK, it's a symbolic head of state. Despite that, 70% of people polled in Japan, just polled, support Princess Ayoko taking the throne. Traditionalists in Japan Parliament are striking back. They are refusing to allow her ever to do it. This monarchy is more than 2,000 years old there. So the next emperor of Japan, the rightful heir according to law there, hinges really on one person, but the line would go like this in order. The emperor's brother, the crown prince Fumihito, who's 60. Then his son, Prince Hisahito, who's just 19 years old and looks like he's half that age. So a 19-year-old would
become
emperor.
Queen Elizabeth was really young.
She was 25.
Okay.
And then the third person would be the current emperor's uncle, who's 90.
Okay, he's out.
Maybe, okay. They might give it to the 90-year-old for a little bit until the 19-year-old can...
Is this controversial in Japan?
Incredibly controversial. Because the current... What is the equivalent to a president in Japan?
The prime minister.
The prime minister of Japan... is a female
for the first time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she's popular, too.
Incredibly popular. So the fact that that type of thing, that glass ceiling has been broken, and they can't do that for this monarchy, for someone as beloved as Princess Diana, is kind of causing a stir right now. And as you said, Queen Elizabeth, she was just 25 years old when she took the throne after her father died from lung cancer, which was not disclosed to the public during that time. They actually did a secret surgery in Buckingham Palace Ballroom in London to remove one of his lungs.
Wow.
It was so secretive during that time that he was even sick. And right now, King Charles is battling cancer. Yep. And we just talked about last week, or earlier this week, Prince Harry and Duchess Meghan Markle, even though there's a royal rift, left the United States to go visit their father. And if you put two and two together, it may have been a final goodbye.
I read today, sourced reporting in People magazine, I think it was, that said that it didn't go well, that the meeting in England didn't go well between Harry and Dad and
really?
Meghan. Yep. Didn't have any detail other than people close to the crown said it didn't go well and it didn't go as Charles had hoped it would go. That's all I read. That I hope that's not true. That's sad.
Well, there's a lot that's of sad. There's a lot of handlers. Diana called them the men in gray suits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Harry wrote as the wasp and the bee.
Yeah.
Named them by different insects. Bee insects.
Okay, so back to the Japan thing. What are your views? Do you think that it should stay like it is in Japan, or do you think it should be like it is in England?
Oh, just like it is in England. Absolutely, 100%. That's insane. In fact, I think Princess Anne should probably be the queen, and her father thought so too, Queen Elizabeth's husband, the Duke of Edinburgh.
Will it change in Japan? Is there an appetite for that, or is tradition so strong that it's unlikely to change?
I don't think it'll change. And there's only like, there's less than 20 direct members. It's like that small of a family. It's not, you know, cousins. It's very, very small. By the way, if you want to come with me around this time next year,
yes,
August of next year, I have the British Crown Royal Tour. So we're going to be going to England. We're going to London. We're going to Buckingham Palace with Fox World Travel. Our Fox host is Rose Gray. We're going to Harrods. Then we're going to go to Stratford-upon-Avon. That's where Shakespeare
beautiful.
Wrote all of his beautiful writings
mm-hmm.
more than 400 years ago, mm-hmm. older than
that's amazing.
America.
Yeah.
I know. We're going to see Stonehenge.
Even older, Stonehenge.
Yeah. Then we're going to go to Windsor. And that's where Harry and Meghan got married. And I'm just so excited to do it. So if you want to text England to 855-616-1620, England to our setting limited talk and text line, 855-616-1620. It'll take you right to the site where you can sign up and take a look. It's 11 days. It's really in depth. Inside Vacations is also taking part in it. So it's going to be very in detail. Text England to 855-616-1620.
Going to be a great trip. So the race for governor has changed. You've been following the news along with us the past couple of days that Sarah Rodriguez's campaign apparently doesn't know where the money went, did not record correctly how much money came in. She held a press conference, and it's just kind of gotten worse from there. Senator Kelda Royce is one of the candidates for governor, and she is with us in the studio. Senator, thank you so much for being here.
I'm so delighted to be with you.
So part of the statement you put out said, the public is getting far too familiar with hearing Sarah Rodriguez apologize. This recurring pattern shows that Rodriguez is unprepared for the rigors of a general election or governing. Should Sarah Rodriguez drop out of this race?
That is not for me or anyone besides her to say. But I can say that we need to focus on how we are going to beat Tom Tiffany and deliver a Democratic legislature. And then, most importantly, actually bring the change that Wisconsinites need.
She is your lieutenant governor, our lieutenant governor. Should she step down as lieutenant governor?
I don't think that is makes any difference. I actually hadn't thought about that whatsoever. I think that she's obviously working through what she's going to do, but I am really focused on what is my path to win this race, because I am the strongest candidate to beat Tom Tiffany. And that is has to be our whole goal here as Democrats.
It's clear that you're familiar with what happened with her campaign. We all are, right? If you read the news, you're familiar with it. Do you believe it was a series of innocent mistakes? Do you think it could have been something more serious?
Listen, I don't want to speculate on that, but I can tell you that in January, when I looked at everybody's finance report, it didn't take me but 5 minutes to know that there was something really wrong with that report, because there were so many duplicates on it. It was obvious. It was evident. And as somebody who has run a small business for 13 years during tough times and good times, I ran a statewide nonprofit for 4 years. I have served on the Joint Finance Committee. I have run 5 campaigns. I cannot imagine not having basic financial safeguards in place where you are checking your bank account balance, maybe not every day, but God, once a week, once a month, where you are making sure that there are multiple people that are involved in every step so that there is oversight, so that if somebody makes a mistake, to say nothing of other challenges, you are catching it. This is so important. You know, voters have the right to know how much candidates are raising and spending. That is one of the hallmarks of our campaign finance system. This is one reason we should have public financing for campaigns, so that we know that our politicians aren't bought and paid for. But at the end of the day, this has got to be right.
So how is your ledger? What have you raised? Because I don't see it posted yet.
No, so I actually put out a release last week saying that I've raised $1.2 million. And, that is money that has been raised in this campaign into my account and also into an independent expenditure on my behalf. And obviously, now that we are in a completely different place in this race, our fundraising trajectory has changed markedly. And there's obviously quite a lot more interest in supporting my campaign because people realize the stakes. We cannot have a nominee who could lose to Tiffany. We need a nominee who can win, who can govern, someone that we can actually trust to deliver for us.
I want to ask you another question about the money, because I think it's too simplistic to look at the number that's reported as being raised, because when you're at different places in your campaign, you might be spending money. Joel Brennan spent money early because nobody knew who he was. You're spending money on TV ads, so it's not the same amount that you could just have sitting in the bank.
Right.
Can you talk about the numbers and which numbers we should look at to really determine strengths in a campaign?
Well, I think you want to look at, first of all, how candidates raise their money, because that tells you a lot about how they're going to govern. I'm really proud that 93% of my contributions, my money, is coming from Wisconsin donors. And, the other 7% is basically friends and family from outside. I was one of the first candidates in the country back in 2011 to say, I'm not going to fund my campaigns with corporate PAC dollars. I've got a policy on my website that states that. I've never taken APAC money. I'm not backed by AI or crypto industries. My money is coming from grassroots donors who care about the state and who live here. And that's very different from how some of the other campaigns are raising their money.
I'm going to ask you a question that I asked Joel Brennan yesterday, who's also running for governor, Democratic side. I'm about the drama. I love this. This is the best part of politics. But it turns a lot of people off.
Hmm.
And from what I saw from his news release and from what you're talking about, there's no talk of substance of why you should be governor. We're just talking about Sarah Rodriguez and how she screwed up. So do you think that this is turning people off to even going to the polls and voting for you?
I think that when people feel like they can't trust their political leaders, it absolutely does turn people off. And I will, point out that I have very detailed plans for what I'm actually going to deliver for Wisconsinites. But we haven't even talked about that yet. I'm going to deliver higher wages for people, more money in your pocket. We're going to deliver lower costs on the big ticket items like housing and health care, child care and utilities. We're going to fully fund public education so that every child in the state gets a great top-notch public education. And I'm going to protect our rights and freedoms from Donald Trump. And those are the hallmarks of my campaign and the vision that I have for making Wisconsin a place where everyone can thrive.
Senator Kelda Royce is with us. She's a gubernatorial candidate. All right, so let's talk about another issue. You voted against a $1.8 billion tax cut in school funding bill negotiated by Republicans and Democrats, leaders in those parties. Marquette polls shortly after that, Senator, showed that 80% of Wisconsinites said legislators should have passed that bill. 80%. We can't get 80% of people to agree that the word Wisconsin begins with a W.
Well, that's a big number. We can get 80% of people to agree that the decision about abortion should remain between a woman and her doctor.
Well, let's stick with this.
Let's stick with this.
80% said that this should have passed. Do you represent those voters? Why did you vote no when so many Wisconsinites wanted a yes vote?
I voted no because it was incredibly fiscally irresponsible, and that was not included in the poll. Now, if somebody asked me, hey, would you like $300? Yes, I would. I'm a human being and money is helpful. I've got, five kids and stepkids. Money is great. But the question really should have been, is it worth giving a tiny bit of money to schools now, which they desperately need? I know that. I care deeply about public education, but only 20% of the money was for public schools. The other 80% was all Republican priorities. And the cost of that would have been, at the next budget, Wisconsin would have a nearly $3 billion deficit. So the question is, do you want $300 million for schools today and then deep cuts in a couple of years? Because I don't. That's not fiscally responsible. And I understand that, Robin Voss was desperate for this deal so that he could try to make his members look like they haven't just spent decades jacking up your property taxes and defunding public education. He wants to hold on to his majority during a potential blue wave year. But my responsibility.
But it was your Democratic, it was the leader of your party who also negotiated this.
One
it was the Democratic governor.
That's true.
And Evers wanted it, right?
Right.
He did. Yeah. He absolutely did because he wanted the school funding piece, as did every Democrat. But rather than negotiate a deal that was right-sized, where maybe each side gets half of what they want, he negotiated a deal where 80% of it was Republican priorities that would have made it impossible for Democrats to actually permanently solve the problem of property tax relief and funding public schools. Now, listen, I am not elected to just do what Marquette polls say. I am elected to do the right thing for Wisconsinites, even when it's hard. And I think that Wisconsin voters value that leadership. They value that independent thought. And that's a big difference between me and Tom Tiffany. Tiffany will do whatever Trump wants. He's a rubber stamp. I think for myself. And sometimes that means I work with my Democratic colleagues very often. But it also means that I've been willing to work with Republicans again and again over more than 20 years to actually pass bills to make people's lives better. And I think that's something Wisconsinites want.
But it's interesting because you and Tom Tiffany agree on this issue. He also didn't want
and
this.
And we both like old fashions. But only one of us is the independent thinker that Wisconsin deserves as governor.
I want to ask you about straw poll at the Democratic convention. The last time you ran, you did very well in the straw poll. I think you could probably correct me, but I think you finished first in the straw poll. Is that right?
I did.
The last time around. This time.
And that tells you how valuable straw polls are.
Yeah, that's part of my question. This time you finished third in the straw poll. A Wedgwood poll released 10 days ago it only listed the top three. So you weren't in the top three. My question related to that, those are things that happened in the past. What are you seeing now with the news of the past couple of days?
Yeah, and we don't actually know what that poll even said. The truth is that there has actually been no public polling in this race. There has been no public polling, and this we know is going to be a very late-breaking race. Most Wisconsinites do not even know that there is an election happening in a month. They don't even know about it yet. And so as folks start to pay attention and look at the candidates, they are seeing our campaign surging because folks want to make sure we have a nominee that we can trust. Someone who can unite all the different voters in the party, everybody from young people who are so disaffected with the status quo, and rightly so, and want real change, to lifelong Democrats who just want a steady, competent adult that they can trust, to folks who voted for Trump but are now seeing how harmful that's been and realizing that he screwed them over. I'm the candidate that can unite them all, and that's why we are betting on, as Wisconsinites, pay attention, my campaign will pick up steam.
How much do you weigh people that support you or back you? Because Jesse O'Poyne with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel just tweeted about 39 minutes ago that you are picking up major support from former backers Rodriguez, Crowley, and Hughes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's wonderful. Listen, we started out with a really great crop of folks running for governor. Over time, that has whittled down, and I'm doing my best to earn every single vote. I want to earn the votes of Democrats, independents, and even fair-minded Republicans, and I am proud to be the candidate that has earned by far the most endorsements in this race. And that is one of the proof points about where Wisconsinites are going to be. Most folks are not paying attention, but the ones who are choosing me. And that is exactly what we need if we're going to unite and beat Tom Tiffany and hopefully deliver a Democratic legislature.
Senator Kel DeRoy's Democratic candidate for governor. You're very busy. We appreciate you joining us in the studio. Thank you.
Great to see you again. Thank you.